So one of the things to take out of this here is not to say that kin selection says that altruism must occur. Okay, we're not saying that. What we're just saying here is that all of the things being equal, altruism is more likely to occur between close family members than non-family members. Okay, there are costs and benefits, though. If, I mean, the benefits are high enough, then if you can gain enough through direct fitness to offset any indirect fitness benefits, then by all means, go for direct fitness. Right? If the benefits to you directly are high enough, kin can be sacrificed. In this case, altruism shifts into selfishness. Actual selfishness, where you benefit and somebody else loses. All right? So, you know, you get the Prince William, Prince Harry, right? Will just got married, yeah. I mean, come on, what's Harry going to get? Nothing. I mean, he's not going to be king. If it was really that important, how do you get to be king? Somebody's got to die. Or at least be publicly so humiliated that he can never assume the throne. Unfortunately, Harry's already been humiliating himself over the years, Nazi costume. I mean, you know, he's got a few. Anyways. But, I mean, you get the idea, right? If the only way you're really going to be that successful is by getting rid of some kin, right? You get rid of some kin. Take home message on this. Biological kinship is important. All of the things being equal, we are likely to see discrimination in favor of close kin. Shavit and colleagues did a study in Israel in 1994 with respect to who would you share air raid shelters with. Family. Family came first. Family came first, then neighbors, then strangers. Bernstein and colleagues gave hypothetical life-death situations based on medical treatment to people and asked who they would provide assistance to, who the drugs go to first. And again, follow that. Family, friends, strangers. But as I said, this isn't something that can be that can't be violated. All right? Kinship is only a single factor in terms of determining behavior here. It comes down to the difference between inclusive and direct fitness. If the direct fitnesses are so large, so direct, then yes, sacrifice family. What about adoption? So again, adoption would seem to violate this idea of kin selection. I mean, even if we just put this into, you know, how could adoption possibly have evolved? Let's consider this. In terms of Hamilton's rule here, RB greater than C, well, if you've got your direct biological children, your R value is 0.5. So whatever the benefit here is, it's got to be at least, you know, twice that of the cost for you. If you've got a completely unrelated individual that you're adopting, R is going to be 0, or so close to it as it doesn't matter. So 0 times any benefit should still be less than the cost. From that perspective, you shouldn't get adoption. So the question is adoption actually a maladaptive system? And if so, how could this be called? Well, one possibility is that it is maladaptive. Another possibility is that adoption is actually just sort of neutral. Third possibility is actually adoption is an adaptive process from an evolutionary perspective. And a lot of this really comes down to asking, who adopts, when do they adopt, and why do they adopt? Now, again, we're very culturally biased. We tend to think about the culture that we're in, look at the adoptions, we take a look at the kind of celebrity adoptions that we hear about in the press and the media, and these tend to bias us towards the interpretation that adoptions are of completely unrelated individuals. And very often they are in the modern situation. But you've got to say, what was it actually like back in the EEA? Well, it's hard to tell. Exactly. But some work that Silk did in the Pacific Islands, South Pacific, from 1990, shows that, in fact, you've got a fairly non-industrialized group of people, which, I mean, we're not dealing with hunter-gatherers in this sense, but they've kept a fairly traditional sort of tribal structure, and she finds that most adoptions amongst these people, the South Seas Islanders, would follow family lines. You would adopt extended family. So nieces or nephews or cousins wouldn't adopt complete strangers. You say, okay, well, but sometimes complete, you know, strangers, unrelated individuals were adopted. Sure, let's take a book out of, say, that Canadian classic, Anne of Green Gables. Right? You ever read the story? Yeah. Well, so what is Matthew? Matthew and Matilda, right? Brother and sister. Okay, they're getting on in age. Matthew comes home with Anne. And Matilda's pretty upset about this, right? Goes to the orphanage. He was supposed to come back with a boy. Why? They needed help on the farm. Look at it this way. It's kind of going to be a reciprocal arrangement. You go and adopt a boy, bring him back, he'll work on the farm, because we're getting old and can't maintain the farm, and frankly, back in the 19th century, there was no old age homes that you were going to go to. So if you couldn't do the work, and you couldn't afford to hire farmhands, it's a trade, it's a reciprocal arrangement. We adopt you, you work. That helps to, you know, you take care of us, your work takes care of us, and eventually you get the farm. Win-win, right? And instead, he comes back with Anne, not so useful for working the farm, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, we all know the story, okay. So, anyways, you look at it that way. In fact, many, if we go back and look at this, adoptions and other relatives might have been extremely pragmatic. In certain cultures, adoptions based upon inheritance. Some cultures, inheritance could only run through a male line. If you did not have a son, then your inheritance would be taken by the state, the crown, the local lord, whatever it was. So, in fact, Julius Caesar adopted Augustus. Octavian. If you know your Roman history, because Caesar had no son, so... But as it turns out, actually, this was his nephew, so he actually adopts his nephew as his own son. In Japan, traditionally, during marriage, if a family did not have sons to carry the name, just had daughters, the guy who marries, the husband that marries the daughter, would take the girl's family name. I mean, in our culture, typically, you know, the wife takes on the, at least just, you know, traditionally, takes on the husband's family name. But in Japan, it would depend. If there was no other sons to carry on the family name, the husband would marry in, take on that family name, and inheritance would run on down that way. So in these cases here, you know, these were essentially issues of adoption. Yeah, in that case, it's actually got a benefit for the individuals involved. When we take a look at... Well, we'll come back to that one, I guess, in a little bit. But so... This idea that it's maladaptive. It's like, well, you know, you got Bradgelina going off and adopting kids from all over, or Madonna. I mean, clearly not related to them. No kidding. But you know what? Is this actually maladaptive for them? Seriously? Is this cutting into their resources? No. People are stunningly rich. It's not cutting into their resources at all. The scheme of things, it's not disruptive in this sense. There's no cost to them in doing this. All right. So, chimpanzees, looking at non-humans, non-human primates here, chimpanzees will try to assist with rearing their nieces and nephews. Goodall has even reported on cases where a mother chimp dies, and one of her older daughters attempted to nurse the newborn, so her sister. Unfortunately, the older daughter wasn't producing any milk. There were other chimpanzees that may have been able to wet nurse the infant, but the kinship bond was so strong here that the older daughter tries to do this, doesn't succeed. Baby chimp dies. But again, that's showing this kinship connection. Yeah.
Examples of adoption,
for example,
Bradgelina,
is that
also seen as
Sure, yeah. Could this be seen as competitive altruism as well? Look how great we are. We're adopting from all these places where kids are having rough lives. Oh, yeah. Yeah, certainly, definitely. Definitely that comes into play. Yeah. So step-parenting, then. Step-parenting is essentially an act of adoption here, as well as an act of getting access to somebody for reproduction. So in step families, we've got a biological parent and a non-biological parent. Now, from an evolutionary perspective, evolutionary psychology perspective, this leads to conflict, right? There are a finite number of resources, energy, ability, years for reproduction available. How is that going to be partitioned? So you've got a biological parent that has some biological kids, and you've got the step-parent, who may or may not have biological children already of his or her own. So you put these together. Plus, you can take the simple situation where our step-parent does not have any children of his or her own here. Well, look, so you've got the biological parent with children, step-parent. Any resources that go into the stepchild are resources that are potentially being taken away from future reproduction, future children that are biologically related to both of the parents. Potential conflict. Let's take an example of lions. Okay, so the pride of lions. It's not exactly how the Lion King would have you believe it works. Females stay with the pride. Okay. So female lions stay with the pride. Young males leave. Actually, young males are driven away. Dad does not go, Simba, someday all this will be yours. You'll get to stay, have sex with all your female relatives, and produce, like, deformed, disgusting, horrible lion. Get the hell out! No, that's what Disney showed you. It doesn't go that way. Right? Someday this will not be yours. You will get kicked out. You will wander around in what's called a bachelor pride for a while. You're not going to hang out with a warthog and a meerkat. Wander on the bachelor pride of other young males, and sooner or later you'll find some other pride where you will attack the dominant male, probably be killed in the process, but if you're lucky and strong enough and tough enough, you'll manage to kill that male off and have maybe 3 or 4 years before somebody else comes along and kills you. Looking great. The circle of life, Simba. Yeah, it really sucks. Zoos are starting to look better all the time. Yeah. Okay. So, females stay with the pride. Young males leave. Eventually, as I said, the dominant male will be displaced. Male lions have evolved to be good really at one sort of thing. Making more baby lions, really. Male lions can hunt, but they're not great. Bachelor prides? I mean, males die in the bachelor prides because they're not really great at hunting. They're a bit too heavy. They're kind of bulky. A lot of muscle. Okay? They're evolved to kill other male lions. The big mane, the rough, the way that lions kill one another, at least the way males kill one another, and the way that lions actually often kill prey, is by latching their jaws around the throat and just constricting until you cut off the air air there, or manage to bite through a carotid. So the big mane, females don't have it, but they fight a different way, as it turns out. Males do. It probably helps to prevent getting another lion getting a good grip on their neck or the throat or trying to go through the spine. So they're evolved really for killing other lions. That's what they're good at. So a male's got maybe 3-4 years tops before some other young male comes in and is going to try to displace him. What that means is if a male comes in, displaces the previous dominant male, if the females are already currently pregnant or have young cubs, he needs to get rid of them as fast as possible. Why? Well, lactation interferes with ovulation. So lactation suppresses ovulation. We talked about these interbirth intervals, how they're drawn out. The longer you nurse, the longer that interbirth interval is. Now you go, how long does a lion nurse for? A few months. You know, not as long as humans do, certainly. But the male's only got 3 or 4 years, and lions don't go into heat every month. Right? They got limited, more limited windows of opportunity. Consequently, the new male will systematically kill off its predecessor's cubs. As well, the new male knows that he's not related to these cubs. He's not the dad. And if he doesn't kill them, right, if he doesn't kill at least the males, he lets them grow up, they could come back and take him out. And you say, well, why does he kill the females off? Isn't that somebody he can mate with? Well, yeah, a few years from now, if he lasts that long, but if he can get the females straight back into estrus right now, or within a couple of months, that's his best chance for producing as many offspring as possible. Okay? So, ovulation is reduced by nursing. If that's reduced, this is an impact on conception. If lactation stops, and it stops by having no cub to nurse, female goes back into heat, new male impregnates, on we go. This is not unique to lions. This is seen in various primates, langurs, for example, various species of birds. Okay. So, in essence, the new male coming in is a stepfather, if you will. New male lion's a stepdad. And what does he do? Kill off the stepkids. Okay. Interesting, no one's asked me, what do the females think about this? Don't they ever protest? I often get that question. Sometimes. But only in specific situations. Remember I said male lions are really good at killing other lions? That's what they're evolved to do. A male lion can kill a female. The male will win. Okay. Once the female's dead, her cub is going to die as well. So look at it from a cost-benefit. Right? If I'm dead, I don't get to reproduce in the future. My cub's dead, I get to reproduce again. And hey, this is apparently a stronger male, because he just took out the previous male. So, if you will, I'm trading up. Now go, wait a minute. Does that always happen? It's like, no. As it turns out, females will try to protect older cubs. Cubs that are closer to either becoming adult, and therefore becoming, if they're female, reproductively available to the male, or if they're males, close to being able to be just driven off and making it on their own. Now, she will try to protect those. At that point, she's invested a lot of energy into those cubs, not just the gestation period, but now big length of time nursing and rearing and raising and training. So she's got a big energy investment here. Now, can the male kill her and her cub? Yes. Should the male kill her and her cub? Probably not. Look, new male has just come in, okay? He's probably a bit beaten up from fighting off the previous male, i.e., well, probably fighting it off, but more likely killing it. If he gets into a real scrap with the female, he's probably going to get hurt. He's going to kill the female, but he'll get hurt some more in the process. There's a whole bunch of other males wandering around just looking for an injured male to pick off. Doesn't do you any good to have just won a pride to lose it the next week to a new male. It's like, okay. The cub's leaving in a couple of months. Fine. Can deal with that. But if we got a years lag on this, no, that's when the cub gets killed. That's when the female doesn't really fight it. How about the human condition? I'm just going to say first off, we are not lions or langurs, so things are a little more complicated here. But work was done by Martin Daly and Margot Wilson starting back in the early 1980s on this. So they got very interested in the human situation. Daly and Wilson are psychologists, and they're kind of, seems a little morbid, but they're kind of obsessed in terms of psychological research with death, generally violent death. They wrote the book, if you will, on murder called Homicide. So basically it's a book called Murder, on murder. Sort of psychological treatise on this. It's a bit old now, but it's still seen as a standard if you're interested in the psychology of killing. But they got interested in this, and so they started taking a look at step family situations because at a point pointed out in a seminar on sociobiology, It's like, but wait a minute, based on sociobiology accounts, shouldn't this mean that stepchildren are at an increased risk because they don't share genetics with both parents? It's like, huh, that's a good point. We should research that. And so they did. And in fact, they found this is exactly what happens. Stepchildren do stand an increased risk of maltreatment from the step-parent. Dolly and Wilson looked specifically at, they've looked at other things, but when they first were doing this work, they looked specifically at cases where stepchildren were killed. Why? Is it just because they're really morbid? No. The reason for this is it's unambiguous. At least within industrialized countries, if a child is dead, there is an inquest. If a child is just bruised or something, you might suspect there's some child abuse going on, but it's hard to prove. Right? My wife apparently was a somewhat clumsy child. Frequently would go to school and grew very tall very quick and apparently gangly. So frequent bruises on arms and legs from tripping over things and whacking into stuff and whatnot. You might suspect there's a case of child abuse here. It wasn't, but you could be suspicious of that. Her sister would frequently, ride her bike straight into a tree. Seemed to have some sort of weird perceptual thing where if there was a tree, she had to try to kill it with the bike and slam into it. Well, probably just fixated on the tree and steered towards it. So, I mean, her sister also horribly beaten up and scratched. But again, not child abuse, just some weird thing with wheeled vehicles. The child's dead. There's coroner's inquest, and a cause of death is determined. So they worked with homicide cases here, not because they thought that other forms of child abuse were less significant, but because there was less ambiguity. So their data should actually be seen as being very conservative, right? Okay. Now, looking at the Canadian situation, so they're Canadian researchers. So Canadian stepchildren stand a 60 times greater risk of fatal abuse by a step-parent than children living with genetic parents. Not a 60% increase, 60 times. 60 times more likely to be killed. You go, holy smokes, why haven't we banned step-parents? Well, it's still, it's like that's, we're just sending these children to their death. No, we're not. Look, 60 times a small number is still a relatively small number out of millions of people, right? So you got to keep this a bit in proportion here, okay? But statistically, this is stunningly significant, all right, in terms of the p-values here. And Dolly Wilson's interpretation is an evolutionary psychology one. It says, well, it has to do with investment. By investing in a non-biological child, the step-parent is engaging in what we've already called genetic altruism. They're putting resources into a non-genetic relative. Any resources to go into that child or children are being taken away from either children that the step-parent has from a previous relationship or any future children that may be had with the genetic parent of the child there. Now, it's not just about murder. Those are the most extreme cases. After Dolly and Wilson start doing research on this, other researchers follow up and look at non-extreme or less extreme but equally problematic situations. Again, focusing on the idea that there are finite parental resources available. So, for example, a sociological study of homeless kids, adolescents, teenagers, so street kids in New York, found that a statistically significant, a higher proportion than chance, come from step families. And the reason they left and went up the streets was either physical abuse or generally lack of resources. Yeah?
I work with homeless kids, and 80% of them, a rough estimate, a lot of them, majority of them, are on the streets because the biological parent has chosen a non-biological boyfriend.
Yeah.
Parent.
Yeah, so. Right, and this is work you're doing. This is you're here in town, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, they're in Edmonton. There we go. Same sort of thing there. So, it's a significant issue. British study found that genetic and step-parents So you've got genetic and step-parents. So they've got a... one child is just genetically related to one parent. Second child genetically related to both parents. Okay, so you've got half siblings. They found they have both the genetic and step-parent have lower educational aspirations for the stepchild, the one that's only got the single biological parent. Now, I mean, they're not saying they have no educational aspirations, not saying they're going to kill the child, but it's like, well, we've got a certain amount of money to put into higher education. We've got two kids. Who do you pick? Pick the one they're both related to. Less marital stress and conflict that way. The biological parent of, you know, is related to both the kids. The step-parent's related to one of them. Go that way. United States. Stepchildren university have been found to receive less financial help from parents than biological children in university. Now, again, you know, this isn't a case where, you know, university students are not being beaten. Step-parent isn't showing up to abuse the child physically at university, but fewer resources. So again, looking at this from a resource perspective, this seems to be fairly significant, and it fits with the evolutionary interpretation. Now, I mean, keep in mind, as I said before, we're not lions or langurs or other types of non-human animals here. We've got an extremely complicated social structure. We've got networks of obligations and connections. You've got stepchildren and the step-parent. You've got the parent and the step-parent. You've got half-siblings that are involved here. And these complicate things dramatically. So, you know, you've got the Cinderella story as one of these sort of motifs, is what happens, the evil stepmother, something. But you also have step-families that are perfectly functional. Life is fine. You don't hear about those, right? Because, you know, it's like with news. Today, absolutely nothing horrible happened. Monty Python actually did a whole skit based upon that, how boring the news would be if nothing unexpected were to occur. So we don't hear about those. So there are perfectly functional step-families. Don't think that all step-families are problematic with respect to children. But we do have these complicated sort of situations here. If we look, though, at... Well, here's another one. I mean, I said we're not lions, right? So let's just hypothesize, you know, to parallel this. Male is going to come in, finds a female that he wants to mate with. Female has child or children from previous relationship. If he's looking to settle down with the new woman, probably the first thing he's going to do, well, we're going to move in together. I've just killed your kids. Okay, help me get my couch inside. Probably not the best way to maintain the future relationship there. So, issues. It's more complicated. You want access to a new mate? Children, stepchildren may just be part of the package. Now, we talked about this earlier in terms of mate choice. We said that this can, in fact, make it harder for individuals who have children from previous relationships to find a new partner. What makes it especially difficult is, in some cases, you know, so I've shown where the individual doesn't mention up front that they have children from previous relationship. Right? If it's concealed, deception, that's a particular biggie. So, these things are complicated with you. If we take a look at some sort of trends, though, interestingly, the severity or the incidence of child maltreatment decreases with the age of the child. There have been various psychologists that have said, oh, this evolutionary psychology thing can't be right. It's not about that. It's things like, say, if you were raised in an abusive environment, you grew up to be a child abuser as well. Sure, no question. Observational learning, definitely. Okay? But things like the severity of maltreatment decreasing as the age of the child increases, this actually makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. So think of our lion here. What do I say? well, if the cub's pretty close to being either reproductively capable as a female or being driven out of the pride to survive on its own, not a big cost for the male to leave it alone, right? If, so in the human case, if you've got a 15 or 16-year-old, what do you have to do? Put up with the child for another couple of years till they're out of the house? Drive them out of the house right now? Not necessarily have to kill him. Right? Which would be an extreme case. What if the child's quite young? You're looking at years and years and years of investment. That's big. The abuse will also tend to decrease as the mother's age increases. Look at it, we've talked about reproductive value. Consider this from the perspective of reproductive value. If the mother is young, if this child is put up for adoption, killed, disadvantaged in some way, she's young, she's probably got a high reproductive value, so she will have more offspring, presumably with perhaps this new male. If she's older, though, if she's approaching menopause, this is what she's got. She's got this child or children. And so you need to protect that because you're probably not going to have any more, or at least the odds of it are low. As you age, reproductive value drops down. You may not be able to replace these children. Okay, so again, we find that abuse decreases as the mother's age increases. And again, these fit with evolutionary interpretations. They don't fit with things like psychoanalytics or Freudian interpretations. They don't fit well with certain other learning behavioral interpretations, but they fit very well with these evolutionary interpretations. We also see, we talked earlier about domestic violence and how only about 1 in 5 cases of domestic violence include cases of biological relatives killing one another. When we take a look at the types of fatal abuse, again, going back to work by Dolly and Wilson, they find that step-parents are likely to kill a stepchild by bludgeoning, kicking, battering. It's a very assaultive, it's a very violent way to very violent way to kill a child. Genetic parents that kill their children generally describe as, we'd say, less assaultive, still fatal, often murder-suicide. You don't generally find step-parents doing a murder-suicide. It's not uncommon in genetic parents. I mean, obviously, there's an exam question sort of that came into this, but so, I mean, we may have cases of mental problems in the parent if you're engaged in a murder-suicide, but regardless, the attempt to, if you will, cause suffering is reduced. And that comes into the kinship process, comes into empathy, these sorts of things. You might go, okay, well, Dolly and Wilson looked at this in terms of Canada. We talked about some stuff in the U.S., Britain. Maybe this is just sort of a weird, North American or British-led to North American-derived system. Not so. These results have been found in a wide range of countries, so U.S., Canada, the U.K., Australia, Finland, Japan, Korea, Nigeria, Hong Kong, Trinidad, and this goes on. These same sort of patterns of step-parental either physical abuse or financial withdrawal, resource withdrawal, have been found in almost all countries. They're not identical. I mean, it's not exactly the same, but there are similar types of patterns. One exception is Sweden. The same pattern has not been found in Sweden. The explanation for this is a little bit, it seems odd. Possibility is that Sweden is a highly, highly socialist state. I mean, you think Canada's socialized? Compared to Sweden, we're really not. IKEA for everyone. The taxation base is very, very high. What this means is a lot of stuff is just provided. Education, you don't really have to pay for any education for your kids. It's just covered. If you're having a hard time dealing with stuff, social workers just show up. Mental health professionals will appear. It's paid for. Health paid for. Having even a rough time getting your housework done, someone will show up, right? Hospice care, all of this. So it's a different situation. So the sort of resource load stresses are rather different. Yes, you're paying a lot more in taxes, but you get, it's a small, well, smaller country for one thing, so less distribution there, but you get a lot in return. So that may be an explanation for why we don't tend to see this in Sweden. I did mention Cinderella, right? In the Cinderella story, it's the evil stepmother with the two ugly stepsisters, right? And you go, so is it really that stepmothers are the ones that are typically killing off their children? Probably not so much fatal, but probably more, you know, other forms of abuse there, kind of as we see with Cinderella. But almost all cultures have a Cinderella-type story. It's not unique to Germany and the Brothers Grimm pulling out the Cinderella story. Most cultures have something like this across the world. And usually in most of these stories, it is in fact the evil stepmother, not the evil stepfather. There's a few cases of lecherous stepfathers out there, which makes a certain amount of sense as the stepdaughters reach reproductive age. You have the lecherous old man coming after her. But generally, it's the evil stepmothers. Why do you think it's an evil stepmother? Why are these fairy tales involving an evil stepmother and not an evil stepfather? Any guesses? Who's likely to tell kids the fairy tales? Mom or dad? Probably mom, right? Dad might be up to it. I mean, kids are around mom. You know, mom's working, doing something there around the house. How do you keep the kids from being too much about? Tell them a story while you're doing something. Well, how's the story go? You know, kids, if I die and your father replaces me, your life's going to be hell. Do you think I'm tough and rough on you? Your life's going straight to shite if I'm gone. So you know what you should do for mom? Here's the moral of the tale, my children. When mom asks you to, you know, clean up and help out and do your chores, you should, because that extra stress on me, I die. Dad's going to replace me, and this is what you're going to get. No, she won't love you. Oh, no, you'll be stuck working in the kitchen. Now, are you going to go help mom and take care of these chores? Good kid. Women, better at social cognition, right? Better at manipulation, right? That's brilliant. Nicely done. Okay, so question then. Are we really dealing with something that's adapted? So, I mean, are we dealing with... and again, it's more often males that are going to result in killing. And if we look at the non-humans, it's generally, again, males that will kill stepchildren and primates and social carnivores and whatnot. So this often seen as like it's a sexually selected process, sexually selected infanticide here, where it's more likely the males that are doing this. In humans, both males and females can be restrictive with respect to resources as well. But so is this really an adapted trait? If we look at this right now, it seems pretty maladaptive. Not either non-adaptive or maladaptive in humans, right? You get caught, you get sent to jail. And frankly, if you get sent to jail, it becomes risky. I don't know if you know much about, you know, prison systems, but prisons have their own hierarchy in terms of crime, okay? You know, horrible murderer of, I don't care, you know, like accountants or... Nazi bikers or whatever. But if you're a child abuser, in the prison hierarchy of things, you're on the bottom, right? Because who are you picking on? Who are you doing violence against? Little kids. Prisons remove the usual social cultural ability to structure hierarchies and dominance. So they develop, they're fascinating microcosms of social behavior, prison systems, just fascinating. You take that away, and so what's the new ranking? Oh, sure, you can be horribly vicious, violent, you know, killing people for drug deals, anything else, but at least you're not killing kids. least you're not abusing kids. Child abusers in prison, they may not make it. They may have to be put into solitary just for their own protection, just to keep them surviving long enough to get out of prison. So there's a hierarchy there. So it's risky. Another fear, even if the even if you don't get caught, someone else suspects you of this, family members, you know, might be coming after the individual. So in the modern world, is this adaptive? Probably not. But again, we've talked about this in terms of evolutionary lag. The costs are still there. The limited resources are still there. The biology that causes people to mentally process availability of resources and how the resources are being distributed within a setting, that's still all there. Take a look at the Yamanamo group in South America, hunter-gatherer group, well, semi-agriculturalist hunter-gatherers in South America, work being done back in the 1960s with them before they had a lot of Western contact, industrialized contact. I can't remember if I mentioned this group before. Have I mentioned these guys already to you? This is a group that I think is the only group I've ever seen cultural anthropologists refer to as those rotten bastards. Usually cultural anthropologists are pretty neutral about the groups they study, but it's like the first time that, you know, one of the things I read about this was the first time they, you know, encounter planes. They ask to be taken up in the planes, and the cultural anthropologist is like, well, okay, that's interesting. We'll see what happens when they're given a world view and recognize there's a horizon, and it's not just this surrounding forest, and see what they think when... But then they started to get suspicious because they all wanted to, the men that went into the plane all wanted to carry a very large rock with them. And basically they found out what they wanted the pilot to do was to fly over the neighboring village, open the door so they could drop rocks on it. Those bastards... is what the anthropologist started to say. So, interesting. But even within this group, recognize that if a man took a new wife, married a woman who had children from a previous relationship, she was expected that she would be sending those children away to live with her relatives, that they wouldn't be part of the new marriage. Either they have to go to her parents or somebody else, or he would just get rid of them. So... again, these are very old issues in terms of surviving closer to a threshold, a resource threshold. Do we live on that kind of resource threshold now? Compared to the EEA, no. Even the poorest of people in Canada aren't really existing in the same way that we did 10,000 years ago. It's different. The problems that we have in our modern society are different in many respects. There's a few other things here to think about as well. As I mentioned, you know, if you're entering into a new relationship here, you're probably not, the first thing you do probably isn't kill the kids, because that's probably not going to set you up for a good long-term issue there. So, this becomes an issue. You have to sort of say long-term, and we're good as humans at looking at long-term. What's the long-term benefit here? What's going to be best? We see this in other situations with parenting as well. So other parental considerations, looking at things like future and present survivorship, future fertility, for example. What kinds of reproductive decisions should individuals make? And some of this comes down to really the issues of their personal genetic fitness. What will you gain from reproduction versus what are you losing in terms of a change in your lifestyle or your life cycle? So once you start having kids, you move from a non-reproductive phase of your existence into a reproductive phase of existence. So any of you have kids? Nope. Okay. If you wanted to, you could probably just go out tonight with no particular restrictions on you. Let's leave aside issues of money and studying and whatnot. You can just go out. You got kids, that kind of changes. Right? Think about the stuff that you do. Think about how having children is going to change that aspect. think about access to potential future mates. If you don't have any children, right, you could be dating a lot. You could be checking out a wide range of possible future mates. Once you have the child, what's going to be best for you in the long run? Sense, pick the best potential future partner. Once you got kids, that kind of changes. Mate choice becomes much more focused at that point. So, this one's a question. Is it a good time to reproduce or not? What do you gain? Well, you gain direct fitness by having offspring, but there's a change in how your life works. By gaining direct fitness, you may be sacrificing a certain amount of things in terms of resource acquisition. So, how do you do that? The more time you're going to put into the kids, the less time you're out collecting other resources. Trade-off. What are these trade-offs? There's environmental constraints, obviously, as well. Depending upon the particular environment, when do you have children become significant? 17th century Germany, for example, during the so-called 30 Years' War, probably resulting in the death of about a third of the population of Europe over about a 40-year period. Okay, so whole collection of religious and dynastic warfare in Germany. Germans are great because they're meticulous documenters of stuff. They just write stuff down. So we know that, in fact, many couples would become engaged, perhaps in the late teens, early 20s, but they wouldn't actually marry until late 20s, early 30s, and start having children. Because it would take that long to acquire enough resources to actually be able to support the children. I mean, we're dealing with a period in time here where there's massive environmental instability due to warfare. So they actually developed what was called fenstering. Fenstering means German for fenster, window. So you're engaged, and basically this was premarital sex. So it was recognized as like, yeah, you're not going to stay engaged for 10 or 12 years probably without having sex. Just try not to get pregnant. So it's the idea of going in through the window, right? Socially, completely acceptable, right? I mean, as soon as you've got a term for it, right, this is recognized as something that's actually happened. After the instability went away, so did the process of fenstering, right, coming in through the window. And, in fact, the ages for marriage went down, and as did the ages for having children. Okay, so different environmental constraints are going to influence this. It influences a lot of things, like multiple offspring. How many children should you have? Well, this gets a little more complicated in humans in that we generally only have a single offspring at a time. But if we look at non-humans, multiple offspring in litters or batches is quite common. And the standard sort of biological approach for this is why do you have multiples is it's called the insurance hypothesis. They may not all survive. If you have one and something random happens, boom, you've lost your entire reproductive ability for, say, that season. If you have more than one, hey, if they all make it, great. But hopefully at least one survives there. The second sort of, and I mean, again, in humans, you know, we don't see this in terms of litters. We don't usually have litters of offspring, but you might have more than one. You're just going to have a single child. How many should you have? Speaking as someone that has now children and has, you know, gone through this whole process, and knowing, you know, because at my age, you know, your groups of association tend to shift and change. So, you know, once you start having kids, you start hanging out with people that have kids. Kind of works that way. But, you know, so being who I am and being a psychologist and asking, unfortunately, difficult questions sometimes, you know, silences that show up at cocktail parties. But, so, you know, discussions that come up. Parents will discuss this. When should you get fixed? Right? When is enough, and when do you send the guy in to... Well, a lot of it comes down to... Parents discuss this, actually. Many, at least... anecdotal evidence, but in, you know, an unscientific poll of the parents that I know, this becomes a discussion. What if, you know, you got two kids, you know, say 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, Should you send dad off right at that point to get fixed? Or do you wait a few years? What if one of the kids dies? Horrible as that is, if you're fixed, you're not replacing a child. Should you wait a few years? And again, completely unscientific poll on this, anecdotal evidence, but the general sort of results I'm getting from various people I've asked is wait a while. Until a little bit old. Yeah, I mean, kids can always die, even as, you know, teenagers, adults, you can die, but still, childhood. Now, again, this raises an interesting issue. I mean, if we look at things historically, death in childhood was very high. You know, getting, say, in some cases, getting one in four of your children past the age of five was a big accomplishment. So, instant of death, there's some cultures that don't actually name a child until it's over a year old, so that you don't get too attached to it, because the odds are it may not make it to a year of life. Only after that do you name it. So, even though that's not usually the case in Canada, it seems our brains perhaps still process this in a way. Anyways, another issue that can come up is what's called the opportunism hypothesis. This one's very resource dependent. We've talked about stability and instability of environments, and trying to make predictions about what the environment's going to be like is difficult. So, say, well, how many children should I have in the, you know, should I have? Well, I don't know. If the times are bad, I should probably put more of the resources into a fewer number of children. But it's difficult to predict what the future is going to bring. If times are good, what if it turns out you think times are going to be bad, but they're actually really good? What if you could have actually supported more kids? Damn, you lost out. Maybe you should therefore try to have more children. If they don't all make it, well, they don't all make it. But if times actually were great and you could support them and you didn't try, you don't get that opportunity. You know, you can't go back in time. Now, this one, as I said, is a little harder to apply to human, but it can be. But this certainly shows up in things like penguins. Anyone see March of the Penguins? No? Terribly tragic film where they follow emperor penguins with little baby penguins dying all over the place. Right? Yeah, tragic, right? Penguins typically have two eggs. Usually, only one of the two survives. And often, neither survive. That's how harsh, right? Antarctica, South America, Tierra del Fuego, parts of New Zealand are for survival. But you have two on the off chance. It's a really great... You say, well, why don't you just have one? Why don't you just put all the energy into one? Well, because if it turns out you've actually had a great year, you know, like every few years just is a great year, and yeah, you'll have enough herring and smelt, and there'll be too few killer whales to eat you, you know, when you go out to fish and bring food back for your offspring. You know, every now and then you get a great year where you actually could have two that will survive. If you don't lay the two eggs, and you don't know in advance, right? You don't know what the season's going to be like, and there's no, like, you know, no farmer's almanac. Oh, yeah, that works. There's no long-term weather forecasting. Yeah, that doesn't really work either. You just don't know until you get through the season. Was it going to be a great year or not? If you don't have the two and it turns out to be a great season, so sad. You could have had twice your genetics passed on, but you didn't do it. So you take the chance. The initial cost of an egg in production compared to the long-term benefits is relatively low. So having multiple offspring, though, probably the best way to look at this probably in terms of humans, primates in general, is insurance hypothesis. If you only have one, you put all your eggs in one basket, basket's dropped, there goes your entire direct fitness. So infanticide, then, by biological parents, can occur. Now, we've got to stress, this is what we call non-normative behavior, right? Most of the cases that we hear about in North America of parents killing their children, there's something psychologically very wrong with the parent, okay? Something has happened here. Postpartum depression, all kinds of things. Now, we will actually talk about issues of things like postpartum depression and depression in general towards the end of the course. We talk about evolutionary medicine. So we'll come hold that sort of in mind here. But we do see cases of biological parents killing their children cross cultures. But it's a last resort. right? It's a case where it comes down to, and there was a question on the exam. You guys did a good job of generally trying to pull this out from material I gave you before, but just to sort of follow up on this, it comes down to often an issue of, as we said before with the lion example, if the parent dies, the child dies as well. If the child dies, the parent has the chance at least to reproduce again in the future. If you've already got other children, you've got a child that's got deficits, deformities, is of low fitness, that's draining resources away from other children that perhaps have a higher fitness. Harsh. Right? We're talking a bit about autistic kids. Autistic kids are a horrible investment from a EEA perspective. Looking at this from the perspective of the EEA, I mean, behavioral therapy? No, I don't think so. I'm sorry. Our autistic child was always going to be, especially if they're on the lower functioning end, a horrible liability for you. Needing constant attention. It's not going to go on. If it's a male, it's definitely not going on to reproduce back in the EEA. If it's a female, maybe might produce a child, but she's not going to be particularly good at caring for it. So, poor investment. Might be better to start over. Harsh? Hell yeah. Really harsh. I've said it before, I'll say it again. We often do not appreciate what an incredibly rich environment we live in now. Most of us, fortunately, will never have to make these kinds of decisions. Count yourself lucky. So, in terms of this, in terms of issues then of optimization, do you abandon the young or the old or both? Right. And again, that may be a decision that has to be made. Is it personal versus offspring survival? If offspring are old enough, they may be able to survive. And you see this. Again, there are numerous historical and cultural, sociological examples of this where if the parent is old enough, if the child is old enough, is on the edge of being able to survive on his or her own, then at that point, yes, you can get parents that will sacrifice themselves for the child. But if the child's young and not able to survive on their own, it's not a good investment. And I mean, think about it. How old do you think a child has to be to actually survive on his or her own? Tough call. Depends on the environment. Go back into the EEA, 10, 12, probably. The odds aren't good, but at least you're in the range of feasibility at that point. Right? By that point, children may have been getting taught issues about snaring, a little bit of hunting, what kind of food can be gathered. Probably still not a good chance of survival, but a possibility. Reproductive value. Right? The older you are, the less likely you are to have more offspring, so the less likely you are to sacrifice a child. If this is what you've got, this is what you have got. So we get into these issues of limited parental resources, and very typically then what we get, I mean, so you have abandonment. Okay, so and if you have abandonment, it probably comes down to parental survival is placed above offspring survival. It's the, if you will, live to reproduce another day situation there. And again, modified by age of parent, modified by environment, modified by issues of where do you abandon? Well, if you've got an orphanage, you might leave the child on the front steps of the orphanage. If you don't have anything, you just leave the child in the forest and walk away. Perhaps the child will be raised by wolves or monkeys. A few stories about that. There actually are documented cases of children, humans raised by non-humans. Few and far between, but there are a few. The most recent documented one came from a child who was about, I think, the age of 4 or 5, and not living in a forest, but living in former Soviet Union satellite republics. Parents were drug-using alcoholics, wasn't getting assistance, wasn't getting care for at home. At some point, you know, able to work doorknobs, so we'd just go and, like, wander around in the streets, dig in trash bins, find food. And at some point, this kid hooked up with a pack of street dogs and basically spent a few years living on the street with the dogs until somebody found him and took him back in and brought him back into the human group. But a good arrangement. I mean, right? The dogs protected him, took care of him, helped him find food. He had an opposable thumb, so could open doors. Dogs couldn't manage, you know. So, you know, flip open trash can lids. So, win-win. That's his choice. Abortion. Abortion is often age-dependent. We take a look at who has abortions. Often young females who lack resources and family support. Those are the women that are more likely to seek out abortions. And then, if we follow along, we get a spike in the late 30s, 40s. That's where moms now got kids that are coming up on, you know, perhaps the 16, 18, 20, and whoops, got pregnant. Now at this point, do you want to be starting over with another kid? You've got adult children who are probably about to start reproducing as well, or do you put your resources into your kids' kids? We've had an interesting one that's happened in Alberta over the last few years. I've got a friend of mine who works as a counselor at abortion clinics. And she says she's noticed an interesting one is the Alberta economy over the last, you know, few years, 4 or 5 years, has been better than a lot of the other parts of the country. We have people coming to Alberta. She said, you know, women from the Maritime would leave their families back in the Maritime, kids, whatnot, would come out to work in Alberta. If they, you know, go back and visit the families. If they get pregnant, though, it's kind of hard to work in Alberta if you're pregnant, right? The whole point of leaving your family behind to come to a good economic climate to work in is to get money to take back to be with, you know, for family or send it back there. Well, if you got pregnant, you've just kind of, so said, you know, spike in those sort of late 30s, early 40s, or even mid-30s. Women who were coming to work in Alberta there. So age-dependent issues there as well. Okay, we're out of time for now, so I will get people's exams back to them.